All right. Hello, this is Scott Price. You're listening to Radio Free World here on CKUW 95.9 FM. Right now I'm joined with Eliakim Sabanda, who is the chair of the History Department here at the University of Winnipeg. Thank you very much for coming in, Kim.
Thank you.
So I brought you in here to talk a bit about Libya and sort of what's going on there. So right now the war in Libya was once billed as this sort of a quick war, something that would be done in a snap. It is now entering, I think, its fourth month now. Now, essentially the justification is they're in there bombing and arming the rebels, or bombing on behalf of the rebels, arming the rebels, to help protect civilians from Muammar Gaddafi's forces. So I just want to get first your initial reaction to this. What is your initial reaction to this going on in Northern Africa, in Libya?
The situation is very interesting in many ways. One being that we are not really talking about it. Say a situation with like Egypt or Tunisia as such. Libya is a little bit unique in the sense that on the side of what I would call the so-called civilians, it's an armed group of people. And also what makes it kind of strange to really fall under the 1973 resolution is that there is the arming of, according to France and those who are doing it, civilians to fight the government. And quite a number of elements that seem not to be compatible with the 1973 resolution of protecting civilians. So in that sense, it is a situation which is very strange. And even those people who actually passed that resolution, there is a lot of division as to what the interpretation of that is. What is it? Is it regime change? Which clearly is something that is not advocated for by the 1973 resolution. Whether some people understanding it is coming under chapter 8 or chapter 7 of the UN resolution. So yeah, in that sense, it's very strange. It's very disturbing as something that is done in the auspices, under the auspices of the United Nations.
Right. Now, talking, you kind of brought the point about where does this fall under? And you're talking about regime change, which is fascinating that there's no mandate for it, as far as if you look at declarations in the UN or any sort of international law, you're not supposed to use military action for regime change, as far as I know. Yet, this is exactly what they're doing. It's quite obvious. They've been trying to kill Gaddafi, and they have a warrant out for him. He's a wanted man. So kind of talk about that dynamic. I mean, kind of almost talking out of both sides of their mouth, right?
Right. And I think the way the resolution was framed, there is something that is strange about it. For instance, the use of all means necessary to protect civilians. And I think that was an overreach. That was stretching, actually, even the spirit, not only the letter of the resolution itself. So in that way, it was very strange. And what is also stranger is that the people who actually voted for the resolution, for instance, like South Africa, and you had, I think, 10 voting for, five abstaining out of that council of 15. No sooner had they left that, then they begin to disagree on the interpretation. NATO, led by France and England, understood that as actually advocating for the use of violence and quick recognition of the Transitional National Council, and many things rapidly happened. And I don't know if you're aware that the first time the no-fly zone actually was affected in Libya, the dropping of bombs, it was on the day that the ad hoc committee, which works under the AU, was supposed to go to Libya and discuss some negotiations. And that was done on the pretext that Libya had started to the plane that was shot, you know. And it turned out they shot their own plane, as it were, the so-called insurgents. And so under a false pretense, deja vu, which really is Iraq, the nuclear weapons, which they used that. And there was no apology from the United Nations if that was done under the name of the United Nations. Anyway, there was deafening silence. But that was used as a pretext to begin to drop bombs, which, of course, you can say it was done under a very false pretext. So you have that. In other words, it would seem to me that NATO and the AU are working at cross purposes. AU is saying we want to try to have Libyans effect an immediate ceasefire and then begin discussing. And they even have gone to an extent that to say that Gaddafi has agreed not to participate in the negotiations, not to stand in the way of the negotiations. And they want then Libyans to talk, but the Transitional National Council has come up with something that is very difficult for the other part to accept. That is, they want any discussion that they participate in to exclude completely Gaddafi. You know, so you have those problems, and it seems to me that the NATO on the other side, it's actually in favor of what the Transitional National Council is saying, but nobody really knows who these are and what their constituents is, because there's never been any poll that has been done to determine, you know, their support. And we know, we have some anecdotally instances where there have been divisions in Benghazi. Some people who say they don't recognize the council. And there were some people in the newspapers who were quoted as saying they didn't recognize them as representing them. So you have that problem of knowing really who are they, who do they represent, what do they stand for? Are they a democratic group? And what are their goals, you know? And so you really have some problems where stretching the understanding of the 1973 resolution has caused some problems and has actually, so far as I'm concerned, become a destabilizing factor itself. That's why AU has said that. Mm-hmm. You know, as war continues in Libya, it has that potential of destabilizing, you know, Africa.
Right. Now, I mean, also, too, it's interesting to see the reaction. What, you know, the AU was, as I understand, trying to work some sort of a ceasefire. And then, like you said, that day they're supposed to have it, the bombing kind of started, right? So, I mean, it's also a very clear picture, in a sense, of what they think of African leaders, in a sense, right? Because here's Libya, an African country where maybe there could have been something resolved, yet the, you know, NATO comes in and kind of just how should I put it, does whatever it wants, really, and says, you know, if you don't like it, too bad, basically. I think that's also an amazing statement by the side of NATO and even the United Nations, that we don't really care, or we don't care enough to do anything about it, right?
Right.
I mean, it's so further into that. Do you think there would need to be some sort of... Is it just a matter of looking at the letter, or these declarations and fixing them and how they're enforced? Or do you need some sort of a restructuring on how the UN works and how, you know, who's allowed into the Security Council? You know, all these sorts of things. Because if you look at the Security Council, if you're from an African perspective, the old colonial masters,
yes,
or the neo-colonial master, mm-hmm, being the United States. So is it just a matter of clearer language and clearer enforcement of that, or do we need a whole restructuring here?
I think there's no question in my mind, and in terms of insofar as whether or not the Security Council has to be restructured, that is a foregone conclusion, and it's something that people have been talking about. India has talked about that, South Africa, and many others, including Germany, and for that matter, which is very interesting. That's an old institution. You put it very well. They represent the colonial masters, and a hegemony that has been found by a number of countries, or the so-called third world countries, is too biased, and sometimes to the extent of totally disregarding the will of people in pursuit of their own interests, which are very economic, and that's the argument that is made of Libya. And having said that, I think the framework of dealing with peace as it stands now is one that is workable, is very clear. And insofar as such enforcement of no-fly zones, and I think the 1973 resolution, especially the chapter under which it's taken, is very clear that it's not really meant to undermine the sovereignty of that particular country. As a matter of fact, the government of that country has a responsibility to protect the citizens and to make sure things are working well, right? And then you try to bring those two groups together and so forth, and working for peace, a peaceful resolution, not a regime change, which is very different. So however much we do recognize the fact that, you know, the structure has to be changed, we do at the same time, I'm keenly aware that within this current framework as it stands, you still can achieve some peace. Mm-hmm. And in other words, there is, of course, a clear violation. Of course, you talked about the ICC, where, of course, they already indicted the chief of intelligence, Gaddafi's second son, and Gaddafi himself. So you have all these things going on, and there are negotiations going on, but you are kind of, whether consciously or unconsciously, undermining those efforts of bringing peace by actually taking a side, rather than waiting until things get to their natural conclusion, and then you begin to do some of those things. Mm-hmm. So I think what the prosecutor has done, which is not really the first time he has done that. I mean, we saw it with Joseph Kony and what was happening when Uganda was saying, we want to talk, and we want to talk with these people. And the general prosecutor for the ICC said, well, of course, we want this guy, even if you are to talk about him. And then the question really that arises from that is, to what purpose is ICC really interested in bringing peace? Would you rather sacrifice the peace of the generality of that citizenry for the sake of just pursuing what you call the letter of the law? So regardless of what happens, politically we know things have happened like that, not that we want permanent clemency, but it has happened as a way of trying to resolve political situations. Hmm. So, I mean, that's what Zuma was saying, that, you know, what ICC has done, the president of South Africa, actually is undermining the work of the ad hoc high-level committee, which has been created by the AU And they had agreed on a roadmap, if we were to go by what they are saying.
Mm-hmm.
They had spoken at those three different occasions with both parties, which is the Transitional National Council and Harafi. They said, well, they seem to have had some tentative agreement on the ceasefire.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you talk about the framework is workable for peace, in my head I was thinking there are so many people out there in the media or even from government who would say, perhaps, but when you have someone like a Gaddafi or a Saddam Hussein running around, so we have to do something a little more extraordinary. Although it's becoming ordinary, but what would be your response to that? Because that would be a common, even from regular people, right? Who would say, "Wow, this Gaddafi guy is a dictator. Would he really want to sit down and negotiate? Should we even bother negotiating with dictators?"
The Western world went into Western world without mentioning in a specific country, basically United States and sometimes supported by some of the people, went in to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan. When was that? Many years ago. And then they went after the same people. And as we speak today, there is no peace. Canada is withdrawing. It handed over things today to United States. And they want to evaluate their presence there. But we still have killing going on. We had the Desert Storm in the early 1990s against Iraq, which was followed by George Bush's war, which was Bring Justice or something, which was there. Killed Saddam, but still we don't have peace. We have more people who have died within that period of time, an argument could be made. And it continues. So what I'm trying to say is that always people think that extraordinary interventions in terms of the military. I think what we have discovered and what we are invariably being reminded of is that really the military solution doesn't work. It has failed in Iraq. It has failed in Afghanistan. It has failed in many other countries. Even during the times when assassinations were very common by the CIA and before Carter actually said, you know, we can't have this.
It didn't. The Congo would be a great example of that.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it didn't. I mean, the Congo, DRC now, as it stands, still continues to be in chaos. So the military solution has never worked. Perhaps it might bring people to the table for discussion. People may say that, but it doesn't have the last word, because it can't be the last word. It only generates violence and violence. Take, for instance, the situation of Libya, as we are talking about right now. Recently, we saw some people who were supporting Gaddafi. I mean, whether or not he is a good person is not really the question at this point. But the question is, how do you bring peace where you have a polarized society, where the person you are seeking to take out has a large following? What do you do? Do you eliminate all of them? If killing, I mean, what do you do? Do you just bomb and or gas everybody and put them to sleep? That's the whole country. You have some problems right there. Which really simple says it won't work. What do? You kill Saddam. I mean, you kill Gaddafi. You turn him into a hero. And yeah, there is that potential, and people rally in his name, and you have war that continues. I think what is on my part very disturbing is sometimes what starts out as being a grassroots protest for genuine social change and transformation is quickly hijacked by market interests and derailed. The question, and also the difference in perspectives Tunisia or any other African country, what are they fighting for? Is the goal the same as what the Western countries understand it to be? Liberal human rights, which of course on democracy, good governance and so forth. Or is it something more? I would argue it's something more. They want economic rights as well. It's not just only the right to vote, the right to freedom of speech. Yes, it's important, but also equally important for them is the economic rights, which sometimes that's where we go. So you have all those, you instill those other people. What do you do to empower people economically? Because that's what they want. So that's where I think there is, in that sense, in that scenario I'm painting, it's possible even for the opposition not to represent the generality of a given country where there is revolution going on. So that's, and as a result of that, what does that lead to? It leads to the fact that you continue to have those things going on and continuing, because what sometimes people go in who intervene, go in under very well, if they are genuine, perhaps very huge misunderstanding of what these people really want. No. It's not merely just going to vote, it's not merely going to, it's more. It's that plus. And the economic rights really being very important for them.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, and which is going to be a challenge. I know there is, of course, like I have said in some of our discussions, it's just off the air, that if somebody stays too long, for me, whether or not they're doing good, really, I'm not, as a person, I don't favor that. I do believe that there's always talent that can, after a while, you reach who you have to step down and give. I mean, I'm not impressed with 41 years being in power. I look dimly at that. I don't like it. But at the same time, I think it's going to be a huge challenge for somebody who is going to come after Gaddafi. If we are to go by what we read, what we have seen happen there in terms of social transformation of the country. In other words, it should be somebody who will be able to meet the economic needs of people. Not necessarily just votes. Otherwise, it's just going to be perpetual revolution.
Mm.
So that's going to be very interesting, where you had a right to shelter, right to transportation, and also women, to an extent, they had their basic rights. They were far more advanced than in other, say Arabic-speaking countries, like Saudi Arabia, you didn't actually do that. Their standard of living was very high, very high. And that would be very interesting to see what happens, especially given the fact that most of these people who are actually doing this are monarchies, and to see whether the country is going to be held together. Add that some of the Western interesting, you know, oil, it seems to me really the civilian, the population they are defending is resources, the general population. And I think the United Nations really will have some problems of trying to understand the situation. I mean, having people understand and accept the situation that for the first time we're seeing, well, openly, United Nations, if we were to believe what they're saying, if France is doing it in the name of United Nations, dropping weapons and so forth to arm people against the government, that'll be the first one, to do it openly. And that's quite a drastic change insofar as the mission of the United Nations is,
mm-hmm.
is concerned.
Well, I mean, you touched on something about the hijacking of these sort of social movements, and when it starts to then get hijacked by market forces, it's interesting, you know, WikiLeaks released some cables just not too long ago in there where it shows a lot of jockeying for position for oil, because there's people from within the NATO camp who, oh, we got a jockey here so the Russians can't come in, and the, you know, so it I'm glad you brought that up, because it certainly has become maybe not ostensibly what you get in a lot of media, but certainly if you start doing some digging, there's no doubt that it seems that it's economic, but not for the Libyan people. It's economic interests of France and Britain and the United States and Canada, for that matter. So, I mean, it's... going back to this framework of peace, then, how is that going to work when you would have... Britain or France or even the United States would ultimately, I would think, be at the table of some sort of discussion. I mean, how do those interests get curbed, really? I mean, how do those interests stay out of these negotiations? Because I think even there's been other incidences where even if they're talking at the table, there still is the political pressure or whatever else, or even the not full-on military pressure, but still the specter of military pressure for people to kind of give in to these... To more Western economic demands rather than demands for their own people. So how does that get curbed then within this framework that you were talking about before?
I think, well, the framework which says you have to respect the sovereignty of the of that particular country, or the sovereignty of the, let me say, the people, and reframe it in that way. If you are protecting the people from being killed, and then of course they have also to survive, the right to work, the right to security, the right to peace, the right to subsistency. So all those things, in a way, and they are supporting that kind of protecting the total human being, as it were, to put it in that sense. So if it were to be understood in that sense, that framework allows for that kind of protection. It is when people begin to stretch it and sometimes go beyond, like what we are seeing happening right now, where you do that, it's no fly zone. It means you are actually taking out hostile flights or planes from that country in order to protect civilians. But I mean, how do you hit Tripoli and still claim that you're protecting people? And I don't see it. We don't. You have some of these many small towns that are bombed almost, bombarded almost every day. How does that protect people? And those people who were on the ship and they couldn't be protected. And you have really a mass of human beings now who have escaped and are going towards Italy or something like that, on the shores and all those other places around there. How is that protecting people? I'm yet to hear really the discussion that highlights the plight of people, and that can be demonstrably, you know, it's just like sometimes people tend to insult the general citizen's intelligence, for one, when somebody simply says, well, you know, Saddam Gaddafi is doing a lot of things, he's even giving Viagra to his soldiers to rape people. I mean, that's really nonsensical. That's an insult to people's intelligence. Yes, he might be a bad person not doing that, but to come up with such a very nonsensical kind of position is insulting to people. Mm-hmm. And rather than really being serious and talking about issues of life and death, of what is happening to people, you come up with something that is pornographic and graphic that's what I'm talking about. It seems as if there is no pressure to talk about the real material needs and safety needs and economic plight of these people now, other than, you know, we bomb because we think, when is the depletion of some of those things, degrading of all that system that is hostile going to happen? With when is it going to end? As you said, it's 4 months. It's now, we're getting to five, actually.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you have all those things that are all actually happening and bombarding all the time, and the killing of people, and which make us believe, which make people believe that they are after Gaddafi and his people. I mean, his family, as it were. Which is not really the mandate of the United Nations. The United Nations is not about going and assassinating leaders in different countries. I think that's I know I'm putting it in a very harsh terms, but that's what it comes across as.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if that happens, then it will make it very difficult for the United Nations to receive cooperation for different countries. So what is it? Are we going to be fighting in order to push? I mean, it's not sustainable. It's not. Negotiations, serious negotiations, will protect people, not military means recklessly effected and camouflaged as, you know, humanitarian. It won't help people.
Hmm.
It won't. So that's the problem which we're having.
Right.
Where we